This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents So You've Been Publicly Shamed, written by John Ronson, narrated by John Ronson. Chapter 1. Braveheart. This story begins in early January 2012, when I noticed that another John Ronson had started posting on Twitter. His photograph was a photograph of my face. His Twitter name was John_Ronson. His most recent tweet, which appeared as I stared in surprise at his timeline, read, "Going home, got to get the recipe for a huge plate of guarana and mussel in a bap with mayonnaise, smiley face, hashtag yummy." "Who are you?" I tweeted him. "Watching Seinfeld. I would love a big plate of celeriac grouper and sour cream kebab with lemongrass, hashtag foodie," he tweeted. I didn't know what to do. The next morning I checked John_Ronson's timeline before I checked my own. In the night he tweeted, "I'm dreaming something about time and cock." He had 20 followers. Some were people I knew from real life, who were presumably wondering why I'd suddenly become so passionate about fusion cooking and candid about dreaming about cock. I did some digging. I discovered that a young researcher, formerly of Warwick University, called Luke Robert Mason, had a few weeks earlier posted a comment on the Guardian site. It was in response to a short video I had made about spam bots. "We've built John his very own infomorph," he wrote. "You can follow him on Twitter here. @John_Ronson. Oh, so it's some kind of spam bot, I thought. Okay, this will be fine. Luke Robert Mason must have thought I would like the spam bot. When he finds out that I don't, he'll remove it. So I tweeted him, "Hi, will you take down your spam bot, please?" 10 minutes passed. Then he replied, "We prefer the term infomorph." I frowned. "But it's taken my identity," I wrote. "The infomorph isn't taking your identity," he wrote back. "It is repurposing social media data into an infomorphic aesthetic." I felt a tightness in my chest. Hashtag woohoo, damn. I'm in the mood for a tidy plate of onion grill with crusty bread. Hashtag foodie, @John_Ronson tweeted. I was at war with a robot version of myself. A month passed. @John_Ronson was tweeting 20 times a day about its whirlwind of social engagements, its soirees and wide circle of friends. It now had 50 followers. They were getting a disastrously misrepresentative depiction of my views on soirees and friends. The spam bot left me feeling powerless and sullied. My identity had been redefined all wrong by strangers, and I had no recourse. I tweeted Luke Robert Mason. If he was adamant that he wouldn't take down his spam bot, maybe we could at least meet. I could film the encounter and put it on YouTube. He agreed, writing that he'd be glad to explain the philosophy behind the infomorph. I replied, I'd certainly be interested to learn the philosophy behind the spam bot. I rented a room in central London. He arrived with two other men, the team behind the spam bot. All three were academics. They'd met at the University of Warwick. Luke was the youngest, handsome, in his 20s, a researcher in technology and cyberculture and director of the Virtual Futures Conference, according to his online CV. David Bausola looked like a rakish teacher, the sort of person who might speak at a conference on the literature of Aleister Crowley. He was a creative technologist and the CEO of the digital agency Filter Factory. Dan O'Hara had a shaved head and eyes that were piercing and annoyed-looking. His jaw was clenched. He was in his late 30s, a lecturer in English and American literature at the University of Cologne. Before that, he'd been a lecturer at Oxford. He'd written a book about J.G. Ballard called Extreme Metaphors and another book called Thomas Pynchon, schizophrenia and social control. As far as I understood it, David Balsola had done the actual building of the spam bot, while the other two men provided research and consultancy. I suggested they sit in a row on the sofa so I could film them all in a single shot. Dan O'Hara gave the others a glance. "Let's play along," he said to them. They all sat down, with Dan in the middle. "What do you mean by play along?" I asked him. "It's about psychological control," he said. "Do you think my having you in a row on the sofa is my way of psychologically controlling you?" I asked. "Absolutely," said Dan. "In what way?" I asked. "I do that with students," said Dan. "I put myself in a separate chair and I put the students in a row on the sofa." "Why would you want to psychologically control some students?" I asked. Dan looked briefly worried that he'd been caught saying something eerie. "In order to control the learning environment," he said. "Is this making you feel uncomfortable?" I asked him. "No, not really," said Dan. "Are you uncomfortable?" "Yes," I said. "Why?" Dan asked. I spelled out my grievances. "Academics," I began, "don't swoop into a person's life uninvited and use them for some kind of academic exercise. And when I ask you to take it down, you're all, 'Oh, it's not a spam bot, it's an infomorph.'" Dan nodded. He leaned forward. "There must be lots of John Ronsons out there," he began. "People with your name, yes?" I looked suspiciously at him. "I'm sure there are people with my name," I replied carefully. "I've got the same problem," said Dan with a smile. "There's another academic out there with my name." "You don't have exactly the same problem as me," I said, "because my exact problem is that three strangers have stolen my identity and have created a robot version of me and are refusing to take it down, even though they come from respectable universities and give TEDx talks." Dan let out a long-suffering sigh. "You're saying there is only one John Ronson," he said. "You're proposing yourself as the real McCoy, as it were, and you want to maintain that integrity and authenticity. Yes?" I stared at him. "I think we feel annoyed with you," Dan continued, "because we're not quite persuaded by that. We think there's already a layer of artifice, and it's your online personality, the brand John Ronson, that you're trying to protect, yeah?" "No, it's just me tweeting," I yelled. "The internet is not the real world," said Dan. "I write my tweets," I replied, "and I press send, so it's me on Twitter." We glared at each other. "That's not academic," I said. "That's not postmodern. That's the fact of it." "This is bizarre," Dan said. "I find it really strange the way you're approaching this. You must be one of the very few people who have chosen to come on Twitter and use their own name as their Twitter name. Who does that? And that's why I'm a little suspicious of your motives, John. That's why I say I think you're using it as brand management." I said nothing, but to this day it kills me that it didn't cross my mind to point out to him that Luke Robert Mason's Twitter name is at Luke Robert Mason. Our conversation continued like this for an hour. I told Dan that I have never used the term brand management in my life. Language like that is alien to me. I said, "And that's the same with your spam bot. Its language is different to mine." "Yes," the three men agreed in unison. "And that's what's annoying me so much," I explained. "It's a misrepresentation of me." "You'd like it to be more like you," Dan said. "I'd like it to not exist," I said. "That's bizarre," said Dan. He let out an incredulous whistle. "I find something psychologically interesting about that." "Why?" I said. "I find that quite aggressive," he said. "You'd like to kill these algorithms. You must feel threatened in some way." He gave me a concerned look. "We don't go around generally trying to kill things we find annoying," he said. "You're a troll," I yelled. After the interview was over, I staggered out into the London afternoon. I dreaded uploading the footage onto YouTube because I'd been so screechy. I steeled myself for comments mocking my screechiness and I posted it. I left it 10 minutes. Then, with apprehension, I had a look. "This is identity theft," read the first comment I saw. "They should respect John's personal liberty." Wow, I thought cautiously. Somebody should make alternate Twitter accounts of all of those ass clowns and constantly post about their strong desire for child porn, read the next comment. I grinned. These people are manipulative assholes, read the third. Fuck them, sue them, break them, destroy them. If I could see these people face to face, I would say they are fucking pricks. I was giddy with joy. I was Braveheart, striding through a field at first alone, and then becomes clear that hundreds are marching behind me. Vile, disturbing idiots playing with someone else's life and then laughing at the victim's hurt and anger, read the next comment. I nodded soberly. Utter hateful assholes, read the next. These fucked up academics deserve to die painfully. The cunt in the middle is a fucking psychopath. I frowned slightly. I hope nobody's going to actually hurt them, I thought. Gas the cunts, especially middle cunt, and especially left side bald cunt, and especially quiet cunt, then piss on their corpses, read the next comment. I won. Within days, the academics took down @John_Ronson. They had been shamed into acquiescence. Their public shaming had been like the button that restores factory settings. Something was out of kilter. The community rallied. The balance was redressed. The academics made a very big meal of eradicating the spam bot. They wrote a Guardian column explaining that their wider aim was to highlight the tyranny of Wall Street algorithms. "It's not just Ronson who has bots manipulating his life, it's all of us," they wrote. I still didn't understand why pretending I eat wasabi dumplings might draw the public's attention to the scourge of Wall Street algorithms. "I have been asked to retire you. Do you understand what that means?" tweeted David Balsola to the spam bot. And, "You have a few hours left. I hope you enjoy them." "Just press the off switch," I emailed him. "Jesus." I was happy to be victorious. It felt wonderful. The wonderful feeling overwhelmed me like a sedative. Strangers all over the world had united to tell me I was right. It was the perfect ending. Now I thought back on the other recent social media shamings I'd enjoyed and felt proud of. The first great one happened in October 2009. The Boyzone singer Stephen Gately had been found dead while on holiday with his civil partner Andrew Coles. The coroner recorded a verdict of natural causes, but the columnist Jan Moyer wrote in the Daily Mail, "Whatever the cause of death is not by any yardstick a natural one. It strikes another blow to the happy ever after myth of civil partnerships." We were not going to tolerate a resurgence of old time bigotry. And as a result of our collective fury, Marks and Spencer and Nestle demanded their advertising be removed from the Daily Mail website. These were great times. We hurt the Mail with a weapon they didn't understand, a social media shaming. After that, when the powerful transgressed, we were there. When the Daily Mail mocked a food bank charity for giving a food parcel to their undercover reporter without running an ID check on him, Twitter responded by donating £39,000 to the charity by the end of the same day. "This is the nice thing about social media," one tweeter wrote about the campaign. "The Mail, which relies primarily on lying to people about their neighbours, can't cope with people communicating amongst themselves, forming their own opinions." When LA Fitness refused to cancel the gym membership of a couple who had lost their jobs and couldn't afford the fees, we rallied. LA Fitness hurriedly backed down. These giants were being brought down by people who used to be powerless. Bloggers, anyone with a social media account. And the weapon that was felling them was a new one. Online shaming. And then one day it hit me. Something of real consequence was happening. We were at the start of a great renaissance of public shaming. After a lull of 180 years, public punishments were phased out in 1837 in the United Kingdom and 1839 in the United States. It was back in a big way. When we deployed shame, we were utilising an immensely powerful tool. It was coercive, borderless, and increasing in speed and influence. Hierarchies were being levelled out. The silenced were getting a voice. It was like the democratisation of justice. And so I made a decision. The next time a great modern shaming unfolded against some significant wrongdoer, the next time citizen justice prevailed in a dramatic and righteous way, I would leap into the middle of it. I'd investigate it close up and chronicle how efficient it was in righting wrongs. I didn't have to wait long. @John_Ronson was put to death on the 2nd of April 2012. Just 12 weeks later, in the middle of the night on the 4th of July, a man lying on his sofa in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, was looking for ideas for his blog when he made a very unexpected discovery. Chapter 2. I'm Glad I'm Not That. In the middle of the night on the 4th of July 2012, Michael Moynihan lay on his sofa. His wife Joanna was asleep upstairs with their baby. They were broke, as they always were. In journalism, everybody seemed to make more money than Michael did. "I can never turn it into money," as he'd later tell me. "I don't know how to do it." They were anxious times. He was 37 and scraping by as a blogger and a freelancer in a walk-up in a not-great part of Fort Greene, Brooklyn. But he just had a job offer. The Washington Post had invited him to blog for them for 10 days. Not that the timing was so great. It was July 4th, he told me. Everyone was on vacation. There were no readers and there wasn't a lot of news. But still, it was a break, and it was stressing Michael out. The stress had just spoiled a vacation in Ireland visiting his wife's family, and now it was stressing him out on his sofa. He began hunting around for story ideas. On a whim, he downloaded the latest number one New York Times non-fiction bestseller from the young, handsome and internationally renowned pop psychology author Joan Alera. It was a book about the neurology of creativity and was called Imagine How Creativity Works. The first chapter, Bob Dylan's Brain, piqued Michael's interest as he was a keen Dylanologist. Joan Alera was reconstructing a critical moment in Dylan's creative career, the thought process that led him to write Like a Rolling Stone. It was May 1965 and Dylan was bored, weary from a grueling tour, quote, skinny from insomnia and pills, sick of his music, thinking he had nothing left to say. As Joan Alera wrote, "The only thing he was sure of was that this life couldn't last. Whenever Dylan read about himself in the newspaper, he made the same observation. God, I'm glad I'm not me, he said. I'm glad I'm not that." So Dylan told his manager he was quitting the music business. He moved to a tiny cabin in Woodstock, New York. His plan was to perhaps write a novel. As Joan Alera wrote, "But then, just when Dylan was most determined to stop creating music, he was overcome with a strange feeling. It's a hard thing to describe," Dylan would later remember. "It's just this sense that you've got something to say." It was no wonder Imagine had been such a bestseller. Who wouldn't want to read that if they're creatively blocked and feeling hopeless, they're just like Bob Dylan immediately before he wrote Like a Rolling Stone? Michael Moynihan, I should explain, hadn't downloaded Joan Alera's book because he was blocked and needed inspirational advice about how to write a Washington Post blog. Joan Alera had recently been embroiled in a minor scandal, and Michael was considering blogging about it. Some columns Lehrer had written for The New Yorker had, it turned out, been recycled from columns he'd published months earlier in The Wall Street Journal. Michael was considering blogging on how self-plagiarism was considered less of a crime in Britain than in America and what that said about the two cultures. But now Michael suddenly stopped reading. He went back a sentence. "It's a hard thing to describe," Dylan would later remember. "It's just this sense that you've got something to say." Michael narrowed his eyes. When the fuck did Bob Dylan say that? He thought. "What made you suspicious?" I asked Michael. The two of us were eating lunch at the Cook Shop restaurant in Chelsea, New York City. Michael was handsome and fidgety. His eyes were pale and darting, like a husky's eyes. "It just didn't sound like Dylan," he said. "In that period, every interview Dylan did, he was a complete asshole to the interviewer. This sounded like a Dylan self-help book." And so on his sofa, Michael scanned back a few paragraphs. "Whenever Dylan read about himself in the newspaper, he made the same observation. 'God, I'm glad I'm not me,' he said. 'I'm glad I'm not that.'" In D.A. Pennebaker's documentary Don't Look Back, Dylan reads an article about himself. "Puffing heavily on a cigarette, he smokes 80 a day." Dylan laughs. "God, I'm glad I'm not me." How did Jonah Lehrer know that Dylan said this whenever he read about himself in the paper? Michael thought. Where did whenever come from? Plus, "God, I'm glad I'm not me" is verifiable, but "I'm glad I'm not that"? When did Bob Dylan say, "I'm glad I'm not that"? Where did Jonah Lehrer get "I'm glad I'm not that" from? And so Michael Moynihan emailed Jonah Lehrer. "I picked up your book and as an obsessive Dylan nerd, eagerly read the first chapter. I'm pretty familiar with the Dylan canon and there were a few quotes I was slightly confused by and couldn't locate." This was Michael's first email to Jonah Lehrer. He was reading it to me back home in his Fort Greene living room. His wife Joanna sat with us. There were baby toys scattered around. By the time Michael emailed Jonah on the 7th of July, he'd pinpointed 6 suspicious Dylan quotes, including, "It's just this sense that you've got something to say," "I'm glad I'm not that," and this angry retort to prying journalists. "I've got nothing to say about these things I write. I just write them. There's no great message. Stop asking me to explain." Dylan did once verifiably say in Don't Look Back, "I've got nothing to say about these things I write. I just write them. There's no great message." But there was no stop asking me to explain. Michael mentioned to Jonah his deadline. He was blogging for the Washington Post for 10 days, and then he pressed send. Jonah emailed Michael back twice the next day. His email sounded friendly, professional, businesslike. Maybe a little superior. His air was that of a smart young academic understanding Michael's questions and promising to answer them during an appropriate moment in his schedule, which would be in 11 days. He was on vacation in Northern California for 10 days. His files were at home, a 7-hour drive away. He didn't want to disrupt his vacation by driving 14 hours to his house to check his files. If Michael could wait 10 days, Jonah would send him detailed footnotes. Michael smiled when he read out that part of Jonah's email to me. 11 days was quite the convenient vacation length, given the duration of Michael's Washington Post contract. Still, Jonah said he'd try and answer Michael's questions off the top of his head. And this, Michael said, was where it all began to unravel for him. This is where he makes his first underplayed lie. He's hesitating. Do I make this lie? Jonah made the lie. "I got a little bit of help," he wrote, "from one of Dylan's managers." This manager had given Jonah access to hitherto unreleased original transcripts of Dylan interviews. If there were any discrepancies with common references on the web, that was why. Jonah's emails continued in this vein for several paragraphs. Dylan had told a radio interviewer to stop asking me to explain in 1995. The interview was transcribed within the pages of a rare multi-volume anthology called The Fiddler Now Upspoke, a collection of Bob Dylan's interviews, press conferences and the like from throughout the master's career. And so on. Then Jonah thanked Michael for his interest, signed off, and at the bottom of the email were the words, "Sent for my iPhone." "Sent for my iPhone," Michael said. A rather lengthy email to send from an iPhone. Slightly panicky. Sweaty thumbs, you know? Who knew if Jonah Lehrer really was on vacation? But Michael had to take him at his word. So they had a lull. The lull made publication in the Washington Post blog impossible, given the digging Michael would need to do. The Fiddler Now Upspoke was a nightmare source. 11 volumes, Michael told me, 12 volumes, 15 volumes. Individual ones cost $150, $200. Jonah Lehrer presumably thought Michael hadn't the wherewithal to trace, purchase and scrutinise an anthology as epic and obscure as The Fiddler Now Upspoke. But he underestimated the nature of Michael's tenacity. There was something about Michael that reminded me of the cyborg in Terminator 2. The one that was even more dogged than Arnold Schwarzenegger, running faster than the fastest car. As Michael's wife Joanna told me, "Michael is the guarder of social rules." She turned to him. "You're a nice guy as long as everyone else." She trailed off. "When I go out in the world," Michael said, "if someone throws some garbage on the street, it's the most senseless thing to me. I lose my mind. Why are you doing this?" "And it's for hours," Joanna said. "We're out on a nice walk and it's a half-hour rant. I see things collapsing," Michael said. And so Michael tracked down an electronic version of The Fiddler Now Upspoke. Well, it wasn't an actual electronic version, but a complete archive of all known Dylan interviews called Every Mind-Polluting Word, Michael told me. Basically a digital version of Fiddler that a fan put together and dumped online. It turned out that Bob Dylan had only given one radio interview in 1995, and at no time during it had he told the interviewer to stop asking me to explain. On July 11th, Michael was in the park with his wife and daughter. It was hot. His daughter was running in and out of the fountain. Michael's phone rang. The voice said, "This is Jonah Lehrer." I know Jonah Lehrer's voice now. If you had to describe it in a word, that word would be measured. "We had a really nice talk," Michael said, "about Dylan, about journalism. I told him I wasn't trying to make a name for myself with this. I said I'd been grinding away at this for years and I'm just, you know, I do what I do and I feed my family and everything's okay." The way Michael said the word okay made it sound like he meant barely okay. It was the vocal equivalent of a worried head glancing down at the floor. I told him, "I'm not one of those young gawker guys going, find me a target I can burn in the public square and then people will know who I am." And Jonah said, "I really appreciate that." Michael liked Jonah. I got along with him. It was really nice. It was a really nice conversation. They said their goodbyes. A few minutes later, Jonah emailed Michael to thank him once again for being so decent and not like one of those gawker guys who delight in humiliation. They didn't make them like Michael anymore. After that, Michael went quiet so he could dig around on Jonah some more. These were the good days. Michael felt like Hercule Poirot. Jonah's claim that he'd had a little bit of help from one of Dylan's managers had sounded suspiciously vague, Michael had thought. And indeed it turned out that Bob Dylan only had one manager. His name was Jeff Rosen, and although Jeff Rosen's email address was hard to come by, Michael came by it. Michael emailed him. Had Jeff Rosen ever spoken to Jonah Lehrer? Jeff Rosen replied that he never had. So Michael emailed Jonah to say he had some more questions. Jonah replied, sounding surprised. Was Michael still going to write something? He assumed Michael wasn't going to write anything. Michael shook his head with incredulity when he recounted this part to me. Jonah had obviously convinced himself that he'd sweet-talked Michael out of investigating him, but no. Bad liars always think they're good at it, Michael said to me. They're always confident they're defeating you. I've spoken to Jeff Rosen, Michael told Jonah. And that, Michael said, is when Jonah lost it. He just lost it. I've never seen anyone like it. Jonah started repeatedly telephoning Michael, pleading with him not to publish. Sometimes Michael would silence his iPhone for a while. Then he'd find so many missed calls from Jonah, 20 calls, 25 calls. He would take a screenshot because nobody would otherwise have believed it. I asked Michael at what point it stopped being fun, and he replied, "When your quarry starts panicking." He paused. "It's like being out in the woods hunting, and you're, this feels great, and then you shoot the animal, and it's lying there twitching, and it wants its head to be bashed in, and you're, I don't want to be the person to do this, this is fucking horrible." Michael got a call from Jonah's agent, Andrew Wiley. "He represents not just Jonah, but Bob Dylan, and Salman Rushdie, and David Bowie, and David Byrne, and David Rockefeller, and V.S. Naipaul, and Vanity Fair, and Martin Amis, and Bill Gates, and King Abdullah II of Jordan, and Al Gore." Actually, Andrew Wiley didn't phone Michael. He got in touch with somebody who got in touch with me to tell me to call him, Michael said, which I thought was very Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. "He's thought to be the most powerful literary agent in the United States, and I'm a schlub. I'm a nobody. So I called him. I laid out the case. He said, 'If you publish this, you're going to ruin a guy's life. Do you think this is a big enough deal to ruin a guy's life?'" "How did you reply?" I asked. "I said, 'I'll think about it,'" Michael said. "I guess Andrew Wiley is a bazillionaire because he's very perceptive, because I got a call from Jonah who said, 'So Andrew Wiley says you're going to go ahead and publish.'" On the afternoon of the last day, Sunday, 29th of July, Michael was walking down Flatbush Avenue on the telephone to Jonah, shouting at him, "I need you to go on the record. You have to do it, Jonah. You have to go on the record." My arms were going crazy. I was so angry and so frustrated. All the time he was wasting, all his lies, and he was simpering. Finally, something in Jonah's voice made Michael know that it was going to happen. So I ran into Duane Reade and I bought a fucking Hello Kitty notebook and a pen, and for 25 seconds he said, "I panicked and I'm deeply sorry for lying." "And there you go," said Michael. "It's done." 26 days, and it took Michael 40 minutes to write the story. He'd still not worked out how to make money from journalism. He'd agreed to give the scoop to the small Jewish Tablet magazine. Knowing how lucky they were, Tablet paid Michael quadruple what they usually pay. But it was quadruple not much. $2,200, which is all Michael would ever make from this story. 40 minutes to write it, and what felt to him like 9 packets of cigarettes. If anything, Jonah Lehrer nearly killed me. I smoked so many fucking cigarettes out on the fire escape. Smoking, smoking, smoking. When you have the ability to press send on something and really, really affect the outcome of the rest of that person's life. And the phone was ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. There were 20-odd missed calls from Jonah that Sunday night. 24 missed calls. 25 missed calls. I'd never seen anyone like it. He kept phoning, Michael's wife, Joanna, said. It was so sad. I don't understand why he thought it was a good idea to keep phoning. It was the worst night of his life, I said. Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure, Michael said. Finally, Michael picked up the phone. I said, Jonah, you have to stop calling me. This is almost to the point of harassment. I felt like I was talking him off the ledge. I said, tell me you're not going to do anything stupid. It was that level of panic. So much so that I thought maybe I should pull back from this. He was, please, 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 like a child's toy breaking, droning, running out of batteries. Please, please, please. Michael asked me if I'd ever been in that position. Had I ever stumbled on a piece of information that, if published, would destroy someone? Actually destroy them? I thought for a while. Destroy someone? I said. I paused. I don't know. I don't think so. I'm not sure. Don't ever do it, he said. He said he honestly considered not pressing send that night. Jonah had a baby daughter the same age as Michael's baby daughter. Michael said he couldn't kid himself. He understood what pressing send would mean to Jonah's life. What we do when we fuck up, we don't lose our job, we lose our vocation. Michael was thinking of former journalists like the New Republic Stephen Glass. Glass was the author of the then-celebrated 1998 story, Hack Heaven, about a 15-year-old schoolboy hacker who was offered a job with a software company he'd hacked into. Glass wrote about being a fly on the wall in the company's offices, Juct Micronics, as the boy negotiated his terms. I want more money. I want a Miata. I want a trip to Disney World. I want X-Men comic number one. I want a lifetime subscription to Playboy and throw-in penthouse. Show me the money. Show me the money. Across the table, executives are listening and trying ever so delicately to oblige. Excuse me, sir, one of the suits says tentatively to the pimply teenager. Excuse me. Pardon me for interrupting you, sir. We can arrange more money for you. Stephen Glass, Washington Scene, Hack Heaven, New Republic, 18th of May, 1998. But there was no conference room, no Juct Micronics, no schoolboy hacker. A Forbes digital journalist, Adam Pennenberg, annoyed that the New Republic had scooped him on his own turf, did some digging, and discovered that Glass had invented it all. Glass was fired. He enrolled in law school, earned a degree magna cum laude, with very great honour, applied in 2014 to practice law in California, and was refused. Glass's shaming was following him around wherever he went, like Pigpen's cloud of dirt. In some ways, he and Jonah Lehrer were eerily alike, young, nerdy, Jewish, preternaturally successful journalists on a roll who made things up. But Glass had invented entire scenarios, casts of characters, reams of dialogue. Jonah's I'm glad I'm not that at the end of I'm glad I'm not me was stupid and wrong, but a world that doled out punishments as merciless as that would be an unfathomable one to me. I thought Michael was being overdramatic to believe that pressing send would sentence Jonah to Stephen Glass-level oblivion. In the end, it was all academic for Michael. He said he felt as trapped in this story as Jonah was. It was like they were both in a car with failed brakes, hurtling helplessly towards this ending together. How could Michael not press send? What would people think if the story got out? That he covered it up for career advancement. I would have been the spineless so-called journalist who buckled to Andrew Wiley. I never would have worked again. Plus, Michael said, something had happened a few hours earlier that he felt made it impossible for him to bury the story. After Jonah had confessed over the phone to Michael, Michael was shaking, so he went to a cafe in Park Slope, Brooklyn, to calm down. It was the Café Régulier du Nord. As he sat outside, he ran into a fellow writer, Vanity Fair's Dana Vachon. I'm doing this story and this guy just fucking confessed to me that it's all phony, Michael told him. Who? Dana Vachon replied. I can't tell you, Michael said. That second Michael's phone rang, the screen flashed up the words, Joan Alera. Oh, Dana Vachon said. Joan Alera. Fuck you, Michael said. You can't say anything. So now Dana Vachon knew. Michael's editors at Tablet knew. Andrew Wiley knew. It was not going to stay contained. So Michael pressed send. Michael had one final telephone conversation with Jonah after they both knew it was over. It was just a few hours before the story appeared. Michael had barely slept that night. He was exhausted. He said to Jonah, I just want you to know that it makes me feel like shit to do this. And Jonah paused, Michael told me, and then he said, no joke, he said to me, you know, I really don't care how you feel. Michael shook his head. It was icy. Then Jonah said to Michael, I really, really regret. Regret what? Michael thought. Cheating? Lying? I really regret ever responding to your email, Jonah said. And my response to him, Michael said, was basically silence. That night, Michael was shattered. I felt horrible. I'm not a fucking monster. I was crushed and depressed. My wife can confirm this. He replayed in his mind their telephone conversations. Suddenly he felt suspicious. Maybe the icy Jonah from that final conversation had been the real Jonah all along. Maybe Jonah had been playing Michael all that time, cranking the emotions to guilt trip him. Maybe Jonah had assessed Michael as pliable and easy to manipulate. When Michael had told Jonah that he'd spoken to Jeff Rosen, Jonah's reply had been, then I guess you're a better journalist than me. That suddenly sounded incredibly condescending to Michael, like he saw Michael as just some putz piddling around trying to pick up freelance work. Maybe everything Jonah had done during the previous weeks was in fact devious and very well plotted. I wondered, had Jonah really been devious, or just terrified? Was Michael conjuring up words like devious in an attempt to feel less bad? Devious is creepy, terrified is human. Having a phone conversation with somebody is like reading a novel, Michael said. Your mind creates a scenario. I sort of knew what he looked like from his author jacket photos, but I'd never seen him move. I didn't know his gait. I didn't know his clothes. Well, I knew he posed in his hipster glasses. But over those 4 weeks, I was imagining this character. I was picturing his house, a little house. He's a journalist. I'm a journalist. I'm a fucking schlub. I pay my rent. I'm fine. I'm happy. But I'm not doing great. This was about the third time Michael had described himself to me as a schlub or some such. I suppose he knew that highlighting this aspect of himself made for the most dramatic, likeable retelling of the collision between the two men. The nobody blogger and the crooked VIP, David and Goliath. But I wondered if he was doing it for more than just storytelling reasons. All the stuff he said about how it wasn't his fault that he stumbled onto the story, how he made no money from it, how the stress nearly killed him, how he was actually trapped into it by Andrew Wiley and Dana Vachon, it suddenly hit me. Michael was traumatized by what he had done. When he'd said to me, don't ever do it, don't ever press send on a story that would destroy someone, it wasn't a figure of speech. He meant it. I was picturing his house, a little house, Michael continued. I was transferring my life onto his. His wife's bustling around, his kids in the background, he's in one of the two bedrooms at the back, sweating. Michael paused. And then my friend from the Los Angeles Times sent me a story from 2009 about the purchase of the Julius Shulman house. The Hollywood Hills residence and studio of the late iconic photographer Julius Shulman has sold for $2.25 million. The mid-century modern steel frame house, built in 1950 and designed by Rafael S. Soriano, is a Los Angeles historic landmark. The buyer is best-selling author and lecturer Joan Alera. His book, How We Decide, has been translated into a dozen languages. The writer has an affinity for classic design. Lauren Beale, Los Angeles Times, 4th of December 2010. It's unfair, Michael said. It's stupid of me. In some ways it's unconscionable to begrudge him his success. But it made things a bit different. A few weeks after Michael told me his Joan Alera story, I was at a party in London, talking to a man I didn't know. He was a theatre director. He asked me what I was writing about and I told him about Michael and Jonah. Sometimes when I recount for people the stories I'm working on, I feel a stupid grin on my face as I describe the absurdity of whatever crazy pickle this or that interviewee had got themselves into, but not this time. As I related the details to him, he shivered, and I found myself shivering too. When I finished the story, he said, "It's about the terror, isn't it?" "The terror of what?" I said. "The terror of being found out," he said. He looked like he felt he was taking a risk even mentioning to me the existence of the terror. He meant that we all have ticking away within us, something we fear will badly harm our reputation if it got out. Some, "I'm glad I'm not that," at the end of an "I'm glad I'm not me." I think he was right. Maybe our secret is actually nothing horrendous. Maybe nobody would even consider it a big deal if it was exposed. But we can't take that risk, so we keep it buried. Maybe it's a work in propriety. Or maybe it's just a feeling that at any moment we'll blurt something out during some important meeting that'll prove to everyone that we aren't proper professional people or in fact functional human beings. I think even in these days of significant oversharing, we keep this particular terror concealed, like people used to do with things like masturbation before everybody suddenly got blasé about it online. With masturbation, nobody cares, whereas our reputation, it's everything. I had leapt into the middle of the Michael Jonah story because I admired and identified with Michael. He personified citizen justice, whereas Jonah represented literary fraud in the pop science world. He made a fortune corrupting an already self-indulgent, bloated genre. I still admired Michael, but suddenly, when the theatre director said the words, "the terror of being found out," I felt like a door had briefly opened before me, revealing some infinite horrorland filled with millions of scared, stiff Jonahs. How many people had I banished to that land during my 30 years of journalism? How truly nightmarish it must have been to be Joan Alera. Chapter 3. The Wilderness. Runyon Canyon, West Hollywood. If you were a passing hiker and you didn't know that Joan Alera had been totally destroyed, you wouldn't have guessed it. He looked like he did in his old author photographs, pleasing to the eye, a little aloof, as if he was thinking higher thoughts and expressing them in a considered manner to his fellow hiker, who was me. But we weren't having a considered conversation. For the last hour, Jonah had been repeatedly telling me, in a voice strained to breaking point, "I don't belong in your book," and I was repeatedly replying, "Yes, you do." I didn't understand what he was talking about. I was writing a book about public shaming. He had been publicly shamed. He was ideal. Now he suddenly stopped, mid-hiking trail, and looked intently at me. "I am a terrible story to put in your book," he said. "Why?" I said. "What's that William Dean Howells line?" he said. "Americans like a tragedy with a happy ending." The actual William Dean Howells line is, What the American public wants in the theatre is a tragedy with a happy ending. I think Jonah was close enough. I was here because Jonah's shaming felt to me like a really important one, the shape of things to come. He was a dishonest number one best-selling author who had been exposed by the sort of person who used to be powerless. And despite seeing Jonah's face etched in panic and misery on the hiking trail, I was sure that the renaissance in public shaming was a good thing. Look at who was being laid low. Bigoted Daily Mail columnists, monolithic gym chains with pitiless cancellation policies, and most heinous of all, horrific academic spam bot creators. Jonah had written some very good things during his short career. Some of his work had been wonderful, but he had repeatedly transgressed. He had done bad things, and the uncovering of his lies was appropriate. Still, as we walked, I felt for Jonah. Close up, I could see he was suffering terribly. Michael had called his cover-up a great deception that was very, very well plotted. But I think it was just chaos, and on that last day, Jonah wasn't icy, but wrecked. "I'm just drenched in shame and regret," he had emailed me before I flew to Los Angeles to meet him. "The shaming process is fucking brutal." Jonah was offering the same dismal prediction about his future as Michael and Andrew Wiley had. He was foreseeing a lifetime of ruin. Imagine being 31 in a country that venerates redemption and second chances and being convinced your tragedy has no happy ending. But I thought he was being too pessimistic. Surely after paying some penance, after spending some time in the wilderness, he could convince his readers and peers that he could change his ways. He could find a way back in. I mean, we weren't monsters. Science writing had been Jonah Lehrer's ambition from the start. After he'd agreed to meet me, I found an old interview he gave his student newspaper 10 years ago when he was 21. He hopes to become a science writer. "Science is too often perceived as cold," he says. "I want to translate science and show how beautiful it can be." Kristen Sterling, Columbia News, December 2002. That interview was published on the occasion of the announcement that Jonah had been awarded a Rhodes Scholarship to study at Oxford as a graduate student for 2 years. Each year, 32 young Americans are selected as Rhodes Scholars, according to their website, chosen not only for their outstanding scholarly achievements, but for their character, commitment to others, and to the common good. Bill Clinton had been a Rhodes Scholar, as had the cosmologist Edwin Hubble and the film director Terence Malick. In 2002, only two Columbia students were awarded the accolade, Jonah and Cyrus Habib, who is now, 10 years on, one of the few fully blind American politicians and the highest-ranking Iranian-American in political office in the United States, serving in the Washington State Legislature. Cyrus Habib sounds amazing. Jonah began writing his first book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, while he was still a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. Its premise was that the great neuroscience breakthroughs of today had all been made 100 years ago by artists like Cézanne and Proust. It was a lovely book. Jonah was smart and he wrote well, which isn't the same as saying Mussolini made the trains run on time. Jonah wrote good things throughout his short career, essays untainted by transgression. After Proust came How We Decide and lastly, Imagine. Along the way, Jonah earned a fortune giving inspirational keynotes at, to name a few of the innumerable conferences he spoke at that I have never heard of, the 2011 International Association of Business Communicators World Conference in San Diego, Fusion, the 8th Annual Desire to Learn Users Conference in Denver, and the 2012 Grant Makers for Effective Organizations National Conference in Seattle. In the last one, he told the story of a young athlete, a high jumper who could never clear the bar, however hard he tried, all the other jumpers mocked him, but then he thought counterintuitively about it, invented a new jumping style called the Fosbury Flop, and won the 1968 Olympic gold medal. By now, Jonah was commanding vast speaker fees, tens of thousands of dollars. I suppose he was being rewarded so richly because his messages were inspirational. My talks tend to be more disincentivizing, which I have noticed pays less. The adjective most often applied to Jonah was Gladwellian, Malcolm Gladwell being the New Yorker writer and author of the era's most successful counterintuitive pop science book, The Tipping Point. Jonah's book jackets looked like Malcolm Gladwell book jackets. Both looked like Apple computer packaging. Jonah was becoming a sensation. When he switched jobs, it was a news story. Jonah Lehrer jumps from Wired to The New Yorker. Jonah Lehrer, the author of the popular science books Proust Was a Scientist, How We Decide, and 2012's Imagine, has left his post as a contributing editor at Wired for The New Yorker, where he'll be a staff writer. In many ways, Lehrer is a younger, brain-centred version of Gladwell, making him a natural New Yorker fit. Carolyn Kellogg, Los Angeles Times, 7th of June 2012. Jonah resigned from The New Yorker after 7 weeks in the job, the day Michael's article appeared. On the Sunday night, the night before publication, he'd been giving a keynote at the 2012 Meeting Professionals International's World Education Conference in St. Louis. The subject of his talk had been the importance of human interaction. During it, according to a tweet posted by an audience member, the journalist Sarah Braley, he revealed that since the invention of Skype, attendances at meetings had actually gone up by 30%. After he left the stage, she found him and asked him where that implausible statistic had come from. "A conversation with a Harvard professor," he replied. But when she requested the professor's name, he mysteriously refused to divulge it. "I'd have to ask him if it's all right to tell you," he explained. She gave Jonah her card, but never heard from him again, which didn't surprise her because the next morning he was disgraced and resigned his job. In the days that followed, Jonah's publishers withdrew and pulped every copy of Imagine still in circulation and offered refunds to anyone who had bought one. The Dylan quotes had been enough to bring Jonah down. His subsequent panic spiral was definitely enough. Michael wrote in his expose that Jonah had stonewalled, misled, and eventually outright lied to him. Internet message boards were replete with comments like, "The twerp is such a huge overachiever that there's something delightful about seeing him humbled," The Guardian, and "Save the royalties from your book, blockhead, because you're going to need the money," New York Times, and "It must be strange to be so full of lies," Tablet. Over in Brooklyn, Michael was agonizing over whether he'd been right to press send. Although he'd essentially seen his takedown of Jonah as a righteous strike against the pop science genre. "To make a tight little package where my mother would be like, 'Ooh, I just read this thing. Did you know that X leads to Y? You have to fucking cut corners,'" Michael said. Andrew Wiley's words were haunting him. Maybe it wasn't enough to ruin a man's life over. But there was worse to come. Wired magazine asked the journalism professor Charles Seif to study 18 columns Jonah had written for them. All but one, he reported, revealed evidence of some journalistic misdeed. It was mainly Jonah reusing his own sentences in different stories, but that wasn't all. "Imagine if I had failed to put quotation marks around the sentences above that I lifted from the Rhodes Scholarship website." It was that kind of pervasive sloppiness slash plagiarism. Probably the worst infraction was that Jonah had taken some paragraphs from a blog written by Christian Jarrett of the British Psychological Society and passed them off as his own. "Michael was massively relieved," he told me, "that the rot spidered out to every book, every piece of journalism." Jonah vanished, leaving a final, innocent, pre-humiliation tweet like a plate of congealing food on the Marie Celeste, Fiona Apple's new album is astonishing, rhapsodizes at SFJ at Joan Alera, 18th of June, 2012. He ignored all interview requests. He resurfaced only once to briefly tell Los Angeles magazine's Amy